yourselves down.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And
Lars.
Now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network, and I want to talk to you about gasoline prices. I know, not a very popular topic. In fact, when you hear the average national price, you say, well, that's not the price anywhere near where I live, and now it looks as though they're going to take another jump. Carlene Johnson joins me now from the Center Square, which I go to on a daily basis. Carlene, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars, nice to talk to you. I don't think I've had the pleasure of talking to you since back in my early KVI days. So it's nice to be able to join you on the program. And
I'm glad to have you on. What's happening at the pump? We're going to get jumped at the pump, as you say.
Goodness. Yeah, jump at the pump. It looks like it's going to be initially about a 6 cent hit come the beginning of July. And then we're going to do these kind of 2% annual increases after that, all as part of this multi-billion dollar transportation package. I sat in on hearing a couple of days ago here in Olympia and watched Republicans offer, I think it was 10 or 11 amendments, of course, all rejected, to try and clean this package up a little bit. And you referenced the Climate Commitment Act funding. There was an amendment in this package to dedicate a certain amount of all the CCA funds for transportation projects, because, as you well know, I hear you talk about it all the time, you know, all the CCA money from the carbon auction credits.
Giant slush fund for just about anything you want to spend it on, right?
It absolutely is, and some of my colleagues at the Center Square have been following that a little bit more intimately than I do, but found out recently that a great deal of the CCA money is going to fund transit and transit-related projects. So essentially, you know, you, driver, filling up at the gas pump, paying a lot more for fuel, are actually paying for people to get on buses.
Yep.
And trains.
Yep.
So that's interesting. And as you point out,
hold on, Carlene, can I throw something in? People should know you pay almost 20 cents a gallon federal tax, then you pay the state tax. But the federal tax, something like 50% of it already goes to transit. So you say, why do we have crappy roads when we're paying all this money in gas taxes? It's because a lot of the money in gas taxes gets diverted to transit that in the Northwest serves about 4.5% of all commuters. And the other 95.5% get to pay the bill.
Yeah, and we're going to go up to 50-some cents, 52 cents or 54 cents a gallon for just state gas taxes, up from the 49.4 or something we're at now. So today, AAA gas prices in Washington average 4.28 for regular, 4.45 for diesel, all our poor truckers. And that's going to go up significantly. And there are other bills that have been passed during this session, Lars, that are going to also affect gas prices, other, you know, emissions-related things that go to add to the price of fuel. And, you know, if people don't pay attention to the fact and understand how inflation works, I know your listeners are smarter than a lot of the radio listeners are, but everything we do here affecting the price at the pump affects everything else. It gets passed on at the grocery store. It gets passed on at the local retailer because the cost of goods to, you know, get them to market are impacted. So,
Carlene, about the CCA, that law, and they said, well, we're just following the law, and the legislature passed the law. The law said that agriculture had a specific exemption from the law. And then Department of Ag told the state bureaucracy, yeah, we haven't had time to get around to that part of it. So we're just charging the farmers the same CCA, you know, the carbon credit nonsense. And that means that's built into the food because the farmers have to buy diesel, as you say. You say, well, weren't they exempted? Yes, by law they were exempted, but Washington State's bureaucracy hasn't had time to, you know, to actually follow the law.
Mm. One of the amendments that was fascinating, the argument over this, which Republicans just beat up every comeback that the Democrats had, which ultimately doesn't matter, right, because they just have the votes to reject the amendment, but was an argument about, okay, instead of trying to fund all these electric buses, which is part of the transportation plan, these school buses, they're forcing these school districts to go electric when, A, those buses cost about 50% more than diesel buses.
Yep.
At least. And in the rural parts of the state where you've got a bus driver is out maybe putting 100 miles more on, is he going to have time to stop down and electrify power his bus up to run the rest of the route? And then you add in the fact that 20% of these buses that we have right now have a daily failure rate. So you've got 100 buses at any given time, 20 of them can't operate. How are we going to possibly force these school districts to electrify their buses? And then can the grid even handle it? Right now, the grid can't even handle the cars that are out there. You're going to put the school buses all electric, but this is what we're doing. Republicans, you know, are powerless to stop it.
You know, Carlene, there's another phenomena that I want to warn people about, because a lot of people kind of perceive the fuel cost of electric cars as zero. They say, well, you just plug it in. Well, you have to pay for that electricity. And I remember when I asked TriMet about their new electric buses, and I said, I want to know the actual fueling costs. And they said a diesel bus costs just over $12,000 a year in diesel for a standard city bus. And I said, what does the electric bus cost? They said about $9,000. I said, so you've got a $3,000 net savings, which is a savings, but it's not gigantic. And if you're paying, in the case of city buses, twice as much, $500,000 for a city bus, $1 million for a city electric bus, and you're only saving $3,000 a year in fuel costs, because I think people think, well, I just bring my car home and plug it into the wall. The fuel doesn't cost anything. They forget it does. Is it as much as the gasoline or diesel costs? No, but it's not a tenth of it either. It's probably about 75%. So you're saving a bit, but not enough to pay for the difference.
Mm. One of the other arguments, too, from Democrats who rejected the amendment was to say, well, we got to, you know, protect our kids. Diesel puts out these harmful particulate, you know, pollution, harmful substances known to increase the risk of, you know, asthma, all this stuff. Representative Dan Griffey, Republican from Allen, who, you know, career firefighter and before that comes from a family of mechanics. The guy is brilliant on this stuff. He said, wait a minute. By federal rules, the diesel that we use now in our school buses is clean.
Yep.
It's different than the diesel of the big trucks out there on the road. So that whole argument is absolutely moot. But again, they make these platitude things, then the Republicans come back and refute it with fact, and then there's an up or down vote on the amendment and they're rejected.
And the Democrats do it anyway. So the Democrats advance an argument, see it beaten by the facts, and say, yeah, we were going to vote for this thing no matter what the facts are. Carlene, I'll encourage people to check out the story that you wrote at the Center Square, and thanks so much for taking the time.
Happy to, always, anytime.
That is Carlene Johnson, staff reporter at the Center Square. As she said, she used to be with our affiliate station, KVI in Seattle.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
You probably heard.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if I asked you if a college instructor was involved in an unprovoked attack on a student in a public place outside of the classroom, simply goes up and begins with another man beating on a young student simply because the young student is wearing a Trump campaign hat. Should any university or any college keep that person on the staff? Well, the guy who's dogged this story from the beginning, and I gave him full credit on Monday, is Jonathan Cho, a journalist with the Discovery Institute, and you can find him online as well. Jay Cho, welcome back.
Lars, can't believe this type of left-wing political violence continues.
And it is, you've identified the thing that concerns me the most. There is a lot of left-wing violence, even against the left. I mean, notice that the guy behind the alleged arson on Governor Shapiro's house, I mean, Shapiro, I think, is a knucklehead, but should he and his family have been attacked with firebombs in the middle of the night? Absolutely not. I may disagree with him politically, but this is crazy. And isn't it all coming from the left and not from the right at this point?
Absolutely, and we should further make a distinction that this is, again, the far left. And in the case back here in Washington at WSU, the instructor is a self-avowed communist instructor who aligns with a lot of progressive groups, unions, and he really has publicly stated several times, especially to students on campus, that he hates conservatives. So then this incident happens, several weeks ago. And, we can get into all the details now. But so far, Lars, I'm the only one who's covering the story. Nobody in local mainstream media has touched this.
And Jonathan, when I it's a rare thing, but during the year, occasionally I'll get on a story and nobody else is on it. That's why I was lavish in my crediting you for this story, because I never liked it when people then finally picked the story up. But I called Wazoo. And I put in a request to their public information officer, they call them BIOs, say, hey, what's the university's response? And I said, I want to know, is this guy still on campus, the instructor who assaulted the student without cause? Is he still on campus? Is he still on the payroll? Is he still teaching classes? Or is he fired? And do you know they literally, because the instructor is a graduate student, they hid and would only say, well, we have to consider a student privacy, but we'll see what we can get for you. So far, Wazoo has put down the cone of silence on this one.
Yeah, and I think that's what's so frustrating, especially for the victim, who also happens to be an Indian-American student by the name of Jay Sani. He's only an undergrad. He's a junior, and he loves America, born here, and a Republican, a conservative. And for this to happen to him, he's still in shock.
Well, and just so people know, I described this on Monday, but based on your reporting, I looked at the videos, both from the police body cams and the surveillance cameras. Jay Sani, engineering student, walks into a popular place. I think it was called, it's called the Coug, and was walking
right outside
out,
the Coug.
Right outside the Coug. So he's walking out with a fairly large bag of I guess, dinner for that night for him and his friends or whatever. And he's just walking out with his head down. He's got his ball cap on. He's not really looking left or right or anything else. And right near a bus, shelter, instructor, Patrick Mahoney, and his buddy go up, who's a Wazoo employee, go up and just begin beating on this young man. And there's nothing that precedes this, you know, that I could tell from the video. It's not as though they yelled at each other or, you know, exchanged epithets or something like that. And the end result is the young man ends up with bruises and cuts and scrapes all over. And I think the university should come out, as you've said. They're under pressure now to fire this communist. But so far, Wazoo won't say what they're doing.
Yeah, and what's so crazy about this situation, it was totally unprovoked. I want to make that very clear. You described it perfectly, Lars. I've reviewed all the body cam and the surveillance videos, every second of it. And this kid, Jay Sani, who's wearing this Trump cap, because he loves Republicans and conservatives and President Trump, is simply walking with dinner in his hand. And Mahoney, along with his friend Gerald Hoff, they ambush him and jump him, hit the cap off his head, and next thing you know, punches are being thrown. Sani says his head was smashed against the concrete as well. And so far, these fellas who were eventually arrested, great police work by Pullman PD, they're only facing fourth-degree misdemeanor charges. And again, I'm bringing up race here because Sonny is obviously Indian-American. These two assailants
are white.
Yep. Yeah, the optics look horrible, but because nothing racially, you know, and nothing racist or political was uttered out of their mouths, they're not charging this as a hate crime.
And yet, the antipathy of Mahoney towards Sonny about his advocacy for Donald Trump is pretty well known, apparently, on campus. And to Jay Sonny, he said, I know this guy doesn't like my position on Trump, but the fact that the university is being silent, Jonathan, this reminds me of all the things that have been happening on college campuses, where the university doesn't have to come out and endorse, you know, the activities of people who act in this way. They just have to stay silent and let it happen and not condemn it. And WSU has not done anything to say we've now permanently suspended him or we're, you know, preparatory to firing him. Instead, they say, oh, we have to protect his privacy. He's a grad student. Is that an adequate response from Wazoo?
Well, many people will disagree with that type of response. And I will, you know, give credit to Republican Congressman Michael Baumgartner out of Washington. You know, he's a Wazoo grad as well. And he put out a statement saying our campuses should be places of free expression, not political violence. WSU must act swiftly to protect students and uphold the values of civility, safety, and constitutional freedom. And other Republicans here in Washington have chimed in to condemn this. And to me, that's a common sense, reasonable response. Yet I've reached out to Democrats here, prominent Democrats, including Governor Bob Ferguson and other lawmakers on the left, and no one has come out to even acknowledge this. And I think that's the type of disconnect we're seeing right now, not just here in Washington, but across America. Especially with these Tesla takedown arson attacks. You have Republicans condemning it, but the left, rarely will you have a Democratic official do that. And I think that's troubling.
Yeah, it is, because it sends the message that you're immediately perhaps a target. So I'm open to the call from Wazoo. I did talk to the Pullman police chief, Aaron Brashears, and he was very responsive. In fact, he called me back directly instead of having somebody else on his staff do it. And he said, yeah, we've given them a criminal citation, and they're out right now. But I want to know from the university, is this crazy guy who's, you know, who allegedly attacked Jay Sonny, I have to say allegedly, on campus, is he still on campus? So in other words, Wazoo, is this guy still a threat to other students whose politics he doesn't like? And, you know, because if he'll attack one student because he doesn't like your politics or you wear the wrong kind or wrong color of ball cap, will he do it to your son or your daughter? Wazoo better come up with some answers. The man who broke the story is Jonathan Cho with the Discovery Institute. Jonathan, it's always a pleasure. Your emails are always welcome. talk@LarsLarson.com. If you want to check out our Instagram feed, you'll find that at the Lars Larson Show on Instagram. If you want to tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show, that's always fun. And of course, you can always call the show. 866-439-5277.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. He may talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You might wonder this. You think, wow, we're finally safe from the predations of Governor Jay Inslee. He's gone, and Rob Ferguson came in. Yeah, he's not much better, but he has shown some signs that maybe he's going to go a different direction than Inslee used to. But now it turns out that maybe this big, fat budget that they want to pass, Democrats want to pass in Olympia, is full of a bunch of goodies for some of Jay Inslee's buddies. Todd Myers joins me now, Vice President for Research at the Washington Policy Center. Hey, Todd, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, happy Monday. Nice to chat with you.
Nice to talk to you as well. Tell me what some of the goodies are that are going to Jay Inslee's friends.
Well, I was going through the budget because, you know, of course, Washington State has a CO2 tax. And so they have a specific fund for the revenue from that CO2 tax. and I wanted to see how they were spending it. And so I noticed that in the proposed House budget that there were three expenditures, all to promote offshore floating wind turbines off the coast of Washington. Now, wind turbines are, floating wind turbines in particular, are very expensive. Offshore wind is rated as one of, if not the most expensive form of energy generation. And so I thought that was sort of interesting. And there are three expenditures of $2 million. But the one that stood out at me was one that was very specific, that said it had to be a Seattle non-regulatory nonprofit organization that promoted Washington's partnership with other West Coast states to promote floating wind turbines. And I was like, oh, they clearly have somebody in mind that they're writing this for. So I just simply Googled that, and I found a group in Seattle whose description on their webpage was virtually identical to the language in the law, that happened to be headed by Jay Inslee's former maritime advisor.
Is that the one called Maritime Blue?
It is. And so the is $500,000 that goes specifically to Maritime Blue. And as I said, the founder and the head of it is Jay Inslee's former maritime advisor. Now, I don't think that he's putting it in a Swiss bank account. I think he actually probably believes in this. But you know, he has friends in the legislature, and he knows how to steer money to his organization in particular, and that's what he's doing. And that's too much of this CO2 money. That's what we see, is it goes to political allies, not to actually helping the planet.
Todd, I know this gets a little bit into the law, and I'm not a lawyer, and I can't remember. I don't think you're a lawyer either. But isn't there something in the Constitution that forbids a bill of attainder? Now, I don't know if it only deals with criminal matters where you say, we're going to write a law against something, and you say, wow, you just made whatever it was Lars did and nobody else in America illegal. That's called a bill of attainder. And the founders of the country didn't like the idea that Congress or legislatures would write laws or write bills that only aimed at one person, either positively or negatively, did they?
So in Washington state, it is illegal to do what is called a gift of public money. You can't say, we're going to send $10,000 to Lars. You have to say, we're going to send, here's a grant of $10,000 to a radio talk show host who lives in southern Washington, whose name has Scandinavian origin. So that's how they do it. And that's why this language is written in such a way that, and so when I saw it, I was like, I know what's going on here. They're trying to get around the prohibition against gifts of public money by describing essentially some, you know, something that only describes one organization.
Well, and by the way, one other detail to this, when you say he's getting $500,000, you say, well, that's for wind turbines. No, it's to promote wind turbines. So it's going to provide some portion. I don't know whether it's 99% or 2% of this guy's budget at Maritime Blue. But it sounds like that money is going to somebody who says, I've promised I'll go out and talk up the idea of wind turbines. That's what it is. It doesn't actually buy anything, does it?
That's correct. So none of the, there are three separate line items that add up to $2 million for floating wind turbines. None of those actually do generate any electricity. All of them are for studies and plans and communications and outreach and those sorts of things. So yes, it is just more bureaucracy, money that doesn't actually help the planet.
Well, why don't you take that bill you just wrote verbally on the air and say, we're going to give $10,000 to Lars Larson. It could be a larger sum if necessary. And I'll promise to promote, I don't know, low taxes, Second Amendment, gun issues, you know, pick your subject. I'll promote all of them. Just send me the check. This is so sleazy. Is anybody in the legislature identified this as just being a gift to Jay Inslee's buddies?
So we highlighted it. We got some very nice coverage on it. And in fact, it's interesting because I started getting phone calls from people saying, hey, you know, here's some other things. And then I got a call from the Ho tribe, which is out on the coast, and they're worried about these wind turbines off of their reservation land. So there are people who are working to try to kill this, but obviously the fact that we are raising billions in taxes while still, you know, wasting millions of dollars for political allies. It just shows how out of touch they are with the real financial situation that we have in Washington state. And they're still sort of addicted to giving money to political allies.
Well, speaking of the concerns of the Ho tribe, remember what happened off Nantucket last year. They built a bunch of brand spanking new, newly engineered, new materials wind turbines, put them out there, and then one of them, within a couple of months, with no major storms or anything else, simply exploded and came apart, and the carbon fiber wreckage from these windmill turbines turned up on six big public beaches. I can understand why the tribes would be concerned. Is anybody else out there evidencing a concern about the fact that wind turbine technology not only is expensive, But it can sometimes just simply self-destruct for no good reason, which suggests that maybe it's not ready for prime time anyway.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I mean, some people have raised those concerns, and I believe that I looked at it. I think the executive order that the president signed banning offshore wind, I think, applies to Washington's coast. But obviously, the legislature is ignoring all of that and putting money in because, again, it goes to state agencies and political allies. That is the priority.
Any sign that they're going to go back and clean this up now that it's had some public exposure, starting with you and then the coverage that you're reporting on it got to?
Let's hope so. They're currently in conference committee between the House and Senate to come up with the final budget. So we won't know whether we have removed it or not. But let's hope so.
Well, I got to tell you something. This stuff just frustrates the daylights out of me. Todd, thanks very much for what you do at the Washington Policy Center.
Yeah, nice to chat with you.
Nice talking to you as well. That's Todd Myers. Anybody think that's a great idea? Because frankly, I think even if you got rid of all these NGOs, there are plenty of private organizations out there who really like the idea of wind turbines. And in fact, the companies that actually make the wind turbines, if you want somebody to promote a product, say you want to promote Ford automobiles, you say, great, Ford Motor Company can do that. If you want to promote some other product, if you want to promote people wearing tennis shoes, I bet Nike and Avia and Reeboks can probably do a bang-up job, and they can do it with their own money instead of taking money from the legislature. Should any legislature, Oregon, Washington, or Idaho, be out taking public money saying, this money is being used to promote an idea? How about don't promote the idea at all? If it has public support and there are private entities, either nonprofits or citizen groups that want to promote the idea, then let them do it with their own dollars. In this case, a state that claims to be functionally broke. In other words, they're short by billions of dollars in their budget, and yet they can still find millions of dollars for nonsense like this. That makes absolutely no sense to me. Glad to have you with me, and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Check out our Instagram feed and our other social media. And you can always tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Time is money.
Ever wonder what a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, and no big surprise here, a group of illegal aliens want to stop the Border Patrol from making what they call warrantless arrests. But federal law says their case does not belong in district court at all. I thought we'd talk about that with Chris Hayek, who is director of litigation at the Immigration Reform Law Institute. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lars.
So tell me this. I had understood, but I'm a non-lawyer, so I don't have a JD by my name. I had always understood that all Border Patrol or ICE needed was probable cause, and they could make an arrest. Is that not the case?
Yes, it is the case. And the law provides for stops of people who the officer has a reasonable suspicion are in the country illegally.
Oh, even lower than PC then, right?
Yeah, it's lower than probable cause, and they can ask for identification. Legal immigrants are required to carry papers at all times. I think today most of them carry it on their phones, but they have to have them. And if you're a United States citizen, you can produce a driver's license, and they can look you up in a squad car and find out you're an American citizen and release you.
Or a legal resident, and just throw in legal resident, because I want my audience to understand. I used to have a producer who was a legal alien, and she literally had to have her green card on her person at all times. And I said, do you ever forget it? Like sometimes I forget my wallet. No, because you can be in big trouble. But you could be a legal resident with a green card, and they can look you up. So what is the what is the thing they're trying to do to put a group of folks together and form, what is it, a class?
A class action. Yeah.
Class action. Yeah, can they go anywhere?
Well, I don't think so, at least not in this case in district court. But even without that argument, which is very true, I mean, they have to go through the administrative process up through the into immigration court and Board of Immigration Appeals, and then they can appeal to, if it goes against them, they can appeal to a circuit court like the Ninth Circuit. And then that just means that the district court doesn't have jurisdiction over this case they brought there. But even without that, the government has done training on this, training officers what reasonable suspicion is, when they can stop somebody in public on a reasonable suspicion that they're in the country illegally. And so it's very unlikely that anybody's going to be arrested illegally, so that they don't face imminent harm and they can't get an injunction, which they're asking for.
So, Chris, is this, I mean, not so much in the legal field, but is it just a stalling action to say we're going to throw this in there because we got to throw the kitchen sink at this? We don't have the law on our side at this point, and so we're going to see if we can stall them off by saying, well, let's take some time to decide if there's a legal case that you have to have more than just reasonable suspicion or probable cause. You have to have a warrant. And while the courts are deciding that, I don't know what they think is going to happen differently once the courts say, no, you don't need that. But where is that likely to go, and why are they doing this?
Well, they think they have an argument that they face imminent arrest from, you know, by ICE doing it illegally. And if they showed that, they would get an injunction saying that ICE has to do it according to the law. And they would get to monitor that. The plaintiffs are asking to be able to monitor ICE's Border Patrol's compliance with the court order, which is a very strange.
Now, hold on. Would they do it personally, or would it be like one of these where a police department runs into trouble and then they have the DOJ in monitoring what they do it? Or would the plaintiffs in this case actually be asking that they or their lawyers go out in the field with ICE agents and watch what they're doing?
No, the ICE agents would have to report to them and say what they did and give them an opportunity to investigate in some sense. And you know, usually it's the court that's responsible for doing that. But that's what they want to do. So they want to inhibit Border Patrol from making these arrests. Just say, it's just not worth the trouble. I don't want to be monitored by them. I don't want to worry about some lawsuit. I'll just let this pass. I won't make the arrest. And that's the goal. And it's ironic that it's the United Farm Workers is the main plaintiff in this case.
What? You mean the same group that Cesar Chavez started, and he didn't like illegal aliens at all? He wanted them arrested because they were a threat to his real constituents, who were actually legitimate farm workers, but in many cases Hispanic or Mexican, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, exactly right. He thought they were strike breakers, and they were, you know, the owners would bring them in, and to weaken the labor movement.
In the last minute we've got, Chris, where's this likely to go? Are the courts going to pay any attention to this at all when the law says you can make an arrest based on reasonable suspicion?
Yes, I think that it's very unlikely that they'll survive here based on jurisdiction. The district courts just don't have jurisdiction of this, and it's a very broad language. It applies to the initial arrest of somebody. If it has to do with a removal action, then it doesn't belong in district court.
Chris, thanks very much. That's Chris Hayek, Director of Litigation at the Immigration Reform Law Institute.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson
the
Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars
and Now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your calls, which I'll do in just a moment. But a bill in New York would ban traffic stops for things like busted lights and the smell of weed. Is that equity, as they're telling us, or just sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card for actual criminals? I thought I'd test that notion with Lance LaRusso, who joins me now, attorney, former law enforcement officer, and the author of several great law enforcement books, most recently Blue News, and the proceeds of that go to police charities. Hey, Lance, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I get so sick and tired of seeing governments at every single level, one in my neighborhood, my neck of the woods in the Pacific Northwest, actually went out and said, we're writing too many tickets to people of color. And they were writing tickets for public consumption of pot, because even in the states where pot is legal, they find you're not supposed to smoke it in public. Okay, fine. I don't like pot anyway, but they were writing tickets, and they said we're writing too many to people of color. Now, is the answer then to adjust it? No. They just got rid of it altogether and said we're just not going to write tickets anymore. Is that somewhat what New York is trying to do by telling police in the entire state, not just in Manhattan, that they can't make traffic stops for minor violations or what?
Well, it's more or what, and it's more Orwellian. What are you thinking is what it comes down to. You know, you pass these laws that say it's illegal to drive around with broken taillights. It's illegal to drive around with bald tires and expired tags. And then you tell law enforcement officers, if you enforce those laws, that you're doing something wrong in the name of equity. And my favorite is, in the way of public safety, we're going to stop these traffic stops. It's nonsense. And just to give you an idea of how crazy it is, you really want to ask the people that are proponents of this, are you okay with Ted Bundy and Timothy McVeigh being at large? Because that's how both of them were taken into custody, one on a bad taillight, I believe it was a license plate light, and the other one on a bad tag. So instead of talking about the fact that law enforcement is the problem, either change the law and make it not illegal to drive around with bad taillights, which they won't do because it's dangerous and it causes wrecks, or tell people to get their taillights fixed and have a campaign. But stop blaming law enforcement when people break the law and they enforce it.
In fact, I was going to ask you, Lance, I knew the examples on Tim McVeigh and Ted Bundy from, again, my neck of the woods, but isn't that one of the most common ways that officers find people who are wanted on various kinds of warrants, including the ones that aren't as famous as McVeigh and Bundy?
Yeah, and this is what's really interesting. In 1 year, I wrote 1,300 traffic tickets, and when I was a patrol officer. And I had somebody say, well, why do you do that? And I was on day shift. And I said, well, there's a very simple reason. Burglars, home burglars, are very difficult to catch inside of a house, but they generally don't drive the speed limit after they break into someone's house.
And that's the way to do it.
And it sounds very elementary, but that's where that aggressive traffic enforcement leads to other crimes. And unfortunately, you see people improperly using this term pretext. Pretext is when you stop someone without a lawful reason for an improper reason based on their race or their sex or their gender or the reason that they're out in the area. When somebody commits a violation of the law, you have probable cause to stop the car and issue a citation. That's not a pretextual stop.
No, it's not. And Lance, I'd invite anybody who thinks this is all being done based on mostly race is the accusation. Go out on a ride along with your local police and do it at night, and then just play a game with yourself and say, I know we're going to pull the guy over or the gal over in front of us. what gender is the person, what race is the person, you know, and all these other questions. And then after the stop has been made, figure out how many you got right. Because I tried that one night, and this was years ago, and I could, you know, it was very, very difficult. You're driving behind a car, it's dark, there are all kinds of headlights and other lights that distract you, and you say, can I tell if that person's even a man or a woman, let alone black or white or Hispanic? It's almost impossible in most cases.
Well, I'll give you an even funnier one, and it just shows the illogic of these laws that are being proposed. Even without illegal window tinting, even without that, it's difficult at night to tell how many people are in the car when you stop it. Traffic stops are one of the most dangerous things law enforcement officers can do. But this bill would prevent you from stopping somebody with illegal window tinting.
Yeah, I saw that as one of the exceptions because the list is crazy. It says expired tags, can't stop them. Taillight out, can't stop them. Too much window tint. The smell of marijuana is detected, can't do that either. And all of this, and then they expect the cops to keep the streets safe.
Well, and it's even worse. What you're basically telling the officers, and this is the heart of this, they're telling the officers that people are criticizing for not performing their jobs according to their oaths, that we want you to disregard portions of your oath and let people drive by with expired tags, even though you know that when somebody has an expired tag, probably haven't renewed their insurance either.
Yeah, and in that case, taking them off the road, I mean, I'm always irritated. Lance, I've never gone without liability insurance on my cars, all the way back to when I was 16 and got my first driver's license. And it is expensive, even if all you're buying is liability insurance. But that's important because all of the rest of us pay uninsured motorist coverage, which costs more to make up for the folks who don't have insurance. And there are states, I think Texas is pretty notorious for saying to people, if you don't have insurance, you can't drive the car. We're not just going to give you a ticket and let you drive on down the road, have somebody else take the car, have it towed, but we're not letting you drive. And you do that just a little bit, I think you get pretty good compliance with the insurance laws. And the insurance laws make a difference. I don't know how many other people wince when they see their monthly or yearly bill for insurance, but my bill's good-sized, and I don't like it. And I've got pretty good rates because I'm married, and I don't have traffic accidents, and I think my last ticket was in 2002. So I'm a pretty boring driver. But even with that, the insurance rates are a lot, and part of what you're paying for are all the people who say, to hell with it. I'm not going to have insurance.
Well, and that's one of the reasons, and this is one of the trends that another one of the trends that you and I have spoken about many times. Instead of holding people responsible, we're going to excuse abject criminality, and we're going to blame law enforcement for being unfair. It's a path that has led to lawlessness. It is a path that has led to the destruction of cities, the loss of tax bases, people leaving cities, and it's a bad path to go down. It's a bad policy path, but it does grab the headlines and it does grab sound bites. So the law enforcement officers just need to stay steady.
And Lance, just so people don't think we're trying to interpolate the race issue into there, they've said openly the measure aims to limit the frequency of traffic stops for minor, what they call minor violations in furtherance of racial equity and public safety. Well, I don't see how you get public safety out of it. What I do see is they're effectively saying if you're breaking the law and it's these kinds of laws, you can go ahead and break them and you don't have to worry that a police officer is going to pull you over. Hey, Lance, thank you very much. I appreciate you being on.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got news for you. Your Second Amendment rights in both the states of Oregon and Washington are rapidly evaporating. And I want to talk about that because the state lawmakers at work in Oregon and Olympia, if you can call it work, to go to those two state capitals and pass laws that are designed to keep law-abiding citizens from doing something that is supposedly protected by the federal constitution, but that protection does not apparently extend to either the Evergreen State or the Beaver State. Dan Mitchell joins me now, who's Sporting Systems in Vancouver and founder of the Washington Civil Rights Association. Dan, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Lars, but I respectfully ask to identify as plaintiff number one.
Plaintiff number one, because you're going to take this into court. House Bill 1163, tell me where it sits right now.
It passed the Senate last night along straight along party lines. It does have to go back to a concurrence committee because the Appropriations Committee changed the implementation date because they knew that they didn't have enough time to get this done. So they extended it from November 2026 until, I believe, May of 2027 for implementation. But outside of that, that's a rubber stamp from the House to agree with that, and then it's off to the governor.
Okay, and so it goes to 27. Does that mean that between now and then, you can buy a gun without going through this process while they figure out what kind of process they're going to have? Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, you'll still be able to do everything under current Washington law. So there's a permit to purchase class now that's free on our website. It's not live fire. There's no delays. It's not anything else. It's not a background check for a background check, anything like that. So up until then, everything's going to be totally normal. So there's no reason to freak out right now. But this is going to court. Absolutely guaranteed. There are multiple groups lining up to have a chance at this in court. So,
well, you know what I'm worried about, Dan, because I'm watching what's happening in both states. So the state of Oregon had Measure 114 barely passed by the voters by a very tiny margin. Then it went to court, was ruled unconstitutional, then to the appeals court, state court of appeals, where it was ruled to be constitutional, and now off to the state Supreme Court, except that in the middle of that whole process, the state legislature appears ready to pass the same thing as Measure 114 and erase Measure 114, the one that's in the courts, which will erase the court case. And then when the new piece of legislation takes effect, then any court effort against it will have to be starting the whole process over, which is hugely expensive. And all this money has already been spent, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to contest Measure 114. I'm worried about the same kind of thing happening in the state of Washington. Should I be?
Oh, absolutely. The liberal left is very well accustomed at using lawfare to their benefit and using court calendars and things like that and rendering cases moot and making a change in the law so that the court case gets thrown out and then they change the law back again. So you absolutely, Oregon and Washington are in the same boat with this. There's lots of other cases ahead of us in the court system. Hawaii's permit to purchase system was just shut down by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So that liberal court has already said, hey, there's a real serious problem with this permit to purchase scheme. And like I said, the testimony that I gave in the Senate a few weeks ago, and the correct version is, these legislatures are in an F around and find out moment. They are playing with wildfire, and we have court cases coming down across the country supporting the Second Amendment. We have a Department of Justice that's turning the ship's bow back towards freedom and liberty. And it's going to take a while for that to happen, but it's in process. And that's the best thing that we have going for us in Oregon and Washington right now, is the fact that the federal government is turning this around. Harmeet Dhillon is now in the Department of Justice Civil Rights Unit, and she's been directed to go after, look at these 12 states that are passing these laws, these reflexive anti-gun laws, and going after the citizens' constitutional rights. She's being given direction to focus on that. And we are at the top of that list. Oregon, Washington, California, the left coast is right square in the sights of the Department of Justice,
well,
and their civil rights division.
I guess the thing I'm wondering about is, we can have President Trump do something and a single federal judge can shut that entire effort down. But you have the Ninth Circus Court on this coast saying you can't have this permit to purchase in Hawaii. The Ninth Circuit includes Hawaii. It also includes Oregon and Washington and California. So you would think that that court decision from the Ninth Circuit Court would actually negate what those legislatures are doing. But it doesn't, does it?
It doesn't. Well, they flatly don't care about the Constitution. They know they have the resources. They know they have the administration's legal resources behind them, you know, the time, the money. Let's pass it. Let's see if we can make it stick. The classic, just throw enough crap against the wall and see what we can get to make stick. But you know, there's some great things that have come from the Democrats in Olympia talking of constitutional rights like this. Steve Dobbs, Secretary of State, just the other day said, laws like this will disproportionately affect rural and underserved communities. He wasn't talking about the Second Amendment. He was talking about voters' rights. Nick Brown went on to say the same thing. We will not let this attempt to assert control over our constitutional rights go unchecked. Again, he was referring to voting, not firearms rights. When did voting become more important than firearms? It's not number two in the Bill of Rights.
No, it's not. And by the way, you know, when you say to people, you have these rights, we don't even have these kind of requirements for somebody to vote. Now, there was a time when America had things like poll tests and poll taxes. And I know they were mostly used by southern states against black voters. But Democrats thought those were anathema because they said, how dare you tell somebody that to vote in an election, you must take a test or you must pay a fee? Well, in this case, they're doing the same thing with firearms, saying in order to exercise this constitutional right, you must take a test and pay a fee. Otherwise, you're not allowed to do it. And yet when it comes to guns, they say, oh, it's perfectly reasonable to demand a test and a fee just to go out and purchase a gun.
A test, a fee, and then a delay on top of that.
Yep.
A new gun buyer's looking at 60 to 90 days to go get this done. And that's if they can find the class and get to it and afford it, because you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of dollars in the training, the permit to purchase, and then the background check fee when you actually do buy something. So there's a huge financial part of this, and the state hasn't dealt with the financial part of this either. They haven't funded this. And even in the funding that WSP put forward, they left out the computer system that's going to make all of this work. They just said, we're going to need some more people. You're going to quadruple our workload, and we just want to double the number of people, and we don't have any budget for a computer system that's going to make all of this stuff happen.
And maybe that's in the plan, Dan, because maybe what they're saying is, and when the computer system doesn't materialize, nobody, no law-abiding citizen will be buying a gun. That's Dan Mitchell, founder of the Washington Civil Rights Association. Support them if you can, because they're the ones who are going to have to take all of this to court. Dan, thanks very much. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. A message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Would you be amazed, would you be proud, if you heard that in the Pacific Northwest there is a place that is building literally the single most expensive high schools in all of the United States of America, and not for any good reason either? And then you have to ask yourself, would I hurt Aaron Mesh's feelings? I mean, after all, he's the managing editor at Willamette Week. If I just said, hey, Aaron, you could fire all the other reporters and just keep Joanna Hu, on staff. She seems to bang out great stories every single week.
It's Joanna Hu, and I couldn't fire all the other reporters. I would have to do all the reporting myself. But I think so highly of Joanna, and I'm delighted to have her on staff.
Okay, now I want to make this clear to people. I'm not, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not exaggerating that in a couple of weeks, ballots are going to go out in the city of Portland asking voters to approve about $1.8 billion in a bond measure, and the folks in charge at the Portland Public Schools haven't yet figured out what they're buying with the money to tell the voters, we like a big pile of cash, but I can't tell you exactly what we're going to buy with it. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's actually in some ways worse than that. They are still arguing about it. Not only have they not like figured it out, they aren't even in agreement about what it is that each thing should cost. They very intentionally chose to put a lot of what I would describe, which we've talked about this before, right? So they very intentionally decided to put an enormous amount of wiggle room into this bond so that they could make make changes in the process on the cost of the high schools and potentially rededicate money over to elementary schools and middle schools.
Do we call that lying, Aaron? Is it fair to call? Because if you went to your mom back when you were a kid, because I did the same thing, and my dad, and say, and he says, how much lunch money do you need this week? And if I had the guts to do it, I said, $50. He says, wow, are lunches that expensive? No, but I got a few other things I need to buy as well. And so just give me 50 and I'll take the lunches out of that and then I'll spend on a few other things. It's the equivalent of that, isn't it?
I don't know that I'd say that's the equivalent. I think the equivalent is more like an allowance for, I keep thinking about like very wealthy couples who the breadwinner of the family gives the spouse an allowance and like there's no discussion of what he or she might spend that allowance on. But there is an understanding that you can't ask for more. And I sort of think that like the trouble here is that there was never any real definition about whether this is going to be used, say, for buying shoes or groceries or trips to Bermuda. And so like the analogy breaks down pretty quickly, but like there is this question of like, where exactly is the money going? And the fact that the school board is still arguing about where the money is going, and the fact that in the attempt to lower the cost of each school project, the cost of somehow managed for two of those projects to go up is pretty alarming.
Well, and not only that, but you and I have talked about the fact they're building high schools for the most part with a capacity of 1,700, when in many cases the schools that they're being, you know, that they're being rebuilt have about 1,000 kids, and the forecast for the next decade is for that number to go down. So you say, we need a high school with room for 1,700 kids. Do you have that? No. We have 1,000 kids in that school. And what's the forecast? That the number of kids going to that school is going to go down. Yeah, but you want us to build a 1,700-student high school at an extraordinary cost. So they're building schools they don't need, and they're going to spend a tremendous amount of money on them. And then they've kind of lumped everything else together, saying, we're going to buy curriculum, technology, deferred maintenance. Deferred maintenance means they took the schools they already have and let them get run down and didn't maintain them. So now they want the taxpayers to pay to fix the lack of maintenance, right?
Right. Although that's a fairly common item in a bond measure, to be fair. Like we see that constantly with the Portland Parks and Recreation Department, with PBOT. Like it's not that uncommon to ask for money for deferred maintenance because you can't keep up with everything. Having said that, again, I think the big concern that people are seeing here is that Baltimore has managed to do these projects for a third of the cost that Portland is suggesting.
Yeah.
Seattle has done them for a significantly lower amount of money.
Almost a third as much. Yep.
Denver is looking at something like a third of the cost that Portland's looking at. And you have to ask the question at a certain point, if all the add-ons, if all the things that you believe are good to have, make your project cost three times what other school districts have, then I think you have three options, only one of which the school board seems seriously willing to consider, or the school district. The board is clearly willing to consider lots of things. But the district could reduce the size of the schools, get rid of some of the add-ons, or simply continue to go forward and ask the voters for more money than anyone else has ever put toward a high school rebuild. And they seem stuck on three.
Now, by the way, just so people know the numbers, Jefferson, Cleveland, and Wells, IDB Wells, are at $491 million, $469 million, $455 million. You say, well, what's that, What's that school in Denver? Denver's comparable to Portland. Oh, well, it has 15 space for 1,500 kids. It's going to cost 139. You take 139 and multiply it by three, and it's almost equal to all those numbers. So, in other words, Denver is building a school that's about the same size as the Portland schools for one-third the cost. And they still haven't figured out where all the other money is going, but they're just going to hand the voters a pig and a poke and say, please vote for this?
And I realize that there are specifics about Portland that are different than Denver, but it's not like we're talking about, I don't know, we're not talking about Chattanooga, Tennessee, where like none of the labor is union or... We're not talking about places that have completely different values than the city of Portland or that don't care about LEED certification. Like, these are cities that are also blue cities. And so I'm continuing to be baffled by how is it we can't seem to find any significant cost cutting.
I think I can know.
I'm not the only one, but there's two school board members who are increasingly irate. They're Herman Green and I apologize, I'm forgetting the other fellow's name.
I read the whole piece.
Gary Hollins. Herman Green and Gary Hollins are raising hell about this.
I love the quote from Herman Green. The math ain't mathin'. Find me another school district in America that's building a single solitary school for $400 and something million, and then let's talk about it. And yet at the end of the day, he says he's still in favor of the voters voting for it, didn't he?
Well, he's on the ballot, too. And I think there's a reality that and I think this is something that Joanna has brought up multiple times in the story in the second half that's important, is that for the district right now, they're more terrified of the parents who expect something from this bond than they are of voters who don't want to spend the money.
Well, to our previous conversations about this, Seattle has the same problem. They have school buildings that are two-thirds occupied. And you say, why don't you consolidate them? Oh, because we're afraid of the parents. Well, tell you what, start being afraid of the taxpayers, because the parents are a tiny minority compared to the taxpayers generally. Most people don't currently have kids in school. And you say, well, I really care about having a school in my neighborhood. It raises the value of my house. I like it because I can walk my kid to school. Good for you. Do you want to spend the money? Well, no, you want everybody else to fund it. And frankly, they need to start consolidating some of these schools. And as long as they behave like this, they're going to see dropping student populations, especially when Governor Kotek comes out and says, we'd rather hang on to DEI and give up $1 billion in federal funds than stop teaching your kids about, you know, racial supremacy and white oppression and all the rest of that nonsense. You got to read this piece by Joanna Ho. You can find it at WWeek.com. The managing editor of Willamette Week is Aaron Mesh. Aaron, thanks very much. Your emails are welcome. talk@LarsLarson.com. And check out my Instagram feed where you'll find I've got a face for radio. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. This musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children.
Hey, teacher, leave the kids alone.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. You know my feelings on unions, and the more I hear about their activities lately, the more it disappoints me, because I understand people have a right to belong to a union. I think it's a foolish idea, but they can do it if they want to. Union operatives are secretly getting paid to infiltrate American workplaces. Are American unions relying too much on backroom deals and secrecy to get their way? Vincent Vernuccio joins me now, president of the Institute for the American Worker. Vincent, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, as always, thanks for having me on.
So what exactly are they doing to infiltrate workplaces? How's this work?
Well, what I'm actually paying a lot of attention to is, I don't know if you saw But the Trump administration on Friday issued what's known as a notice of proposed rulemaking. So they announced this rule was going to come down. And if you're talking about, you know, public employees and especially federal employees, they're actually making it easier to remove lower performing or other federal employees that are doing misconduct and basically turning them into what almost all the private sector is, which is at-will employees. So there's
good.
About 50,000 federal employees that are in a position to affect policy that could really throw sand in the gears of the president's agenda. And President Trump, his administration, is saying, well, okay, if you know you can affect policy, then you should be able to be removed and not have all these additional hurdles if you're not doing your job.
Well, and there's nothing wrong with it because, Vincent, I mean, one of the most frustrating things about unions, especially in public employment, is they go by a rule of last hired, first fired. And you say, well, hold on, does that mean you sometimes fire people who are the last hired, who may be the best worker in the workplace, and you're hanging on to people who may be good workers, or that maybe they're the deadbeats or just waiting for retirement? Why wouldn't you just fire them, or if you're forced to do a RIF, let them go based on their value to the organization? But the unions have never allowed that, have they?
That's right. It's called last in, first out. And, you know, we see this in a lot of union contracts. You see this, you know, in a lot of parts of government where, you know, if you're a probationary employee or you were just hired, then, you know, if there's some sort of downsizing or if they have to reduce the workforce, you're the first person on the chopping block. And it doesn't matter how hard you are, how good you're working, how much value you're providing the taxpayer or in the public employees, you know, how much value they're providing the taxpayer. If it's just you don't have the time and you're the easiest to get rid of, and usually a union contract will say last in, first out. And yeah, you could be removed no matter how good you are.
Well, and what floors me about this is, Vincent, I hear from people who are fans of unions, who are friends and acquaintances and all that. And they'll always tell me, well, when you hire a union worker, you're hiring a highly trained highly trained professional. And I say, that's great. So why doesn't the union say, if you're not one of our best workers, then when they let folks go, you ought to be the first out the door? But of course, they protect the people who've been there the longest, whether they're good or not. I mean, sometimes the person who's been there the longest knows everything about the job, knows how to get it done fast, and is a fantastic worker. And sometimes they're not. And yet, if you want to hold up that tradition saying union-trained workers, union-represented workers are highly skilled professionals, would any profession want to say, but you should hang on to us based on tenure, not based on whether or not we bring actual value to the table?
You know, I think this is why, you know, you see a lot of workers just, you know, saying that, you know, they don't want to be part of the union or they're not buying the union current business model, which is last in, first out, which is against the merit system, which is, you know, get raises based on seniority or how long you've been on the job or, you know, how many degrees you have, not how much value you provide or how much or how hard you are working. So, you know, this is why you've seen union membership really be, you know, steadily decline over, you know, the last several decades, especially in the private sector, because, you know, workers want to be rewarded for how hard they work, how good they are, how much they, you know, help increase value for their employer or, frankly, the taxpayer if you're talking about public employees. So you're right, unions can do a lot of good, but they've got to get out of this kind of industrial revolution mentality of, yeah, last in, first out, only way to get ahead is by logging another year in the job. They don't embrace this new dynamic economy where workers want to be rewarded as individuals.
Well, and in fact, if you did it that way, and when somebody, a private, a non-union workforce came in and said, hey, we can do their job, and they say, oh, no, these guys are so good about it because their union makes sure that all the people we get are the best trained, the best prepared, and the best at their job. If you were to let people go when they show that they're not really worth their salt, then you say, okay, then we're going to end up with the best trained people on the job. When the unions choose to go the other way and just say, we deserve this as a sinecure because we've been around a long time, therefore you have to keep us around, I've always figured that my boss, I don't like, I've only been unionized a couple of times in my life, and I decided to decertify, and we actually did decertify a bargaining unit. But I've said to my boss, I don't care how long I've been around. What you should be asking is, what have you done for me lately? Vincent, thanks very much. That's Vincent Vernuccio, president of the Institute for the American Worker, about the new efforts by the Trump administration to say if we need to let people go, we should let them go because of how they're skilled or not skilled.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go right to the head of the line. We'll get to the X poll a bit later. But I want to talk about trees. Now, I've been talking about trees on this show for close to 30 years. And one of my biggest frustrations, and some of it has been addressed recently with Donald Trump's tariffs, was to say, why does America have almost 200 million acres of forests, and yet we import lumber from other parts of the world, and notably from Canada? It doesn't make any sense to me. And then when you live in the Pacific Northwest and you love the forests and you see them go up in smoke every single summer and they burn, and people say, well, is there anything we can do to stop that? And the answer is logging and replanting. And logging and replanting is one of the best renewable resources out there. It should make the greenies very, very happy when you go out and actually harvest the timber from the forest instead of letting it go up in smoke and then replant them and have brand new growing forests. Nothing should make your heart go pitter-pat like that. Well, I thought we'd talk about it with Dr. Bob Zybak, who's a forest scientist and president of Northwest Maps Company, author of the new book called The Elliott, an Anthology. Dr. Zybak, welcome back.
Thanks, Lars. It's good to be back.
Well, I want to know whether or not you see some light at the end of the tunnel, at least from the federal level, with the president saying we want to get loggers back out into the forests of the whole country, but the Pacific Northwest in particular.
I think there's a lot of light at the end of the tunnel. Finally, after 30 years, the last time there was this opportunity was the Clinton plan in the early 90s. But we definitely need to increase harvest, increase rural jobs, and decrease wildfire risk and damage.
Well, in fact, the numbers I've seen recently suggest we're maybe logging 3 billion board feet out of the federal forest. And to put that into context, at one point the region was harvesting about 12 billion board feet. If those numbers are wrong, please feel free to correct them. But we're harvesting a tiny fraction of all the trees we could be cutting down and have more grow in a way in which we never run out of trees.
That's correct. We also had tens of thousands of rural jobs at those times, and we didn't have catastrophic wildfires. One of the key reasons, not only is logging, but keeping the roads and trails open and accessible, both to loggers and to the public.
Which also speaks to another thing. We're told that these are public forests, but then the Forest Service for a long time has been simply going in and not just neglecting the roads, but actively using taxpayer money to destroy the roads so they are unusable, as though this is something that's going to help the public when you tell them you have a forest, but you have fewer ways to get in or out of it, whether you're fighting fires or just going out to recreate in property that belongs to everybody in this country.
That's exactly right. And another problem, in addition to creating the roadless areas, which have directly contributed to these wildfires, is after a wildfire, instead of salvaging the land like we did for probably thousands of years, but certainly up until 1990, they simply put a gate across it and block public access. And some of the blockage is to known recreation areas. My recent article on Cedar Creek Fire out of Oak Ridge was on that very issue. We had to get a special permit to enter an area that should have been salvage logged, that had been gated off from the public for 2 years instead of any active management.
Now, do you see any signs of at the end of the tunnel when you look at the way that the state of Oregon or the state of Washington have been managing their trees? Because it sounds like the state of Oregon and the state of Washington are going to try to stick to the old school let it burn philosophy. Am I wrong?
I'm not sure about the way they manage wildfires, but things such as the HCPs, which create fuels and remove 60 or 70 or 80% of the potential jobs, are coming under fire. People are starting to realize these are dubious federal regulations, government control issues, and have nothing to do with science. To say that these things are created for fish or birds is not true. But it's cost us billions of dollars in lost revenues and trillions of dollars in damage, these types of passive management approaches.
Now, you wrote a resolution that was aimed at the 2025 Oregon Logging Conference. Tell my audience about that, if you would.
Now, that's specific to the Elliott. The Elliott would be a perfect
right.
example of the misdirection of HCPs. We were
Hold on, doctor. I gotta explain. HCPs are habitat conservation programs, right?
Yes, they're a government act.
I wanted the people listening to understand the terminology. So,
they're government regulations that take away people's ability to manage the riparian areas, and also require constant government certification and checkups. So we're replacing loggers and blue-collar workers with government bureaucrats. The problem is, and the Oregon Department of Forestry is going to see this very quickly, is that these things are counterproductive. They are firebombs, they're expensive, and they require taxpayers to fund these types of set-asides. So I think the science, and I'm putting quotes around that, that created these regulations is currently under fire with the new administration, and rightfully so. It's just too bad it didn't happen 20 or 30 years ago.
So, Dr. Zybak, what's the better way to get it done?
Go back to active management, keep our roads and trails open, protect our old growth instead of burning them up, and that way we save millions of wildlife lives, dozens of human lives, and tens of thousands of structures, just as we did for 100 years. We actively managed our forests. We did not have these wildfires, and we did not have this gross unemployment or people living in tents on sidewalks. It's been a major change in how we manage our forests and how we react to wildfire, and we need to revert back to proven methods to resolve these problems.
And by the way, so my audience understands, when you say active management, you mean go out in the woods, take good care of them, cut trees, do it sensibly, replant the trees, and when there is a fire, put it out quickly, and then harvest or salvage log the logs that are left behind in the fire, because there's a lot of there are a lot of board feet of timber, of lumber, that are left in those burned trees, aren't there?
Yes, and the sooner you get to it, the more valuable it is. And active management means maintaining recreational facilities as well as roads and trails for public access or for management purposes.
Is Governor Kotek's Forestry Department listening to you on this?
No. It's like they've been overtaken. The main director just retired a while ago, and they've been losing money and having to ask for additional funds. So I don't think they're paying much attention.
And if we actively manage quickly, would it pay for itself?
Well, it would show a major profit. We demonstrated that for 30 or 40 years. We put hundreds of millions into our schools, into our rural economies, into our roads and parks. And we know how to do this. We were shown how by our grandparents and great-grandparents.
No doubt. That is Dr. Bob Zybak, forest scientist, president of Northwest MAPS, and routinely ignored by the powers that be in Salem.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Most People always ask Lars if he wants to run for public office, like president.
Do you know how much power I'd have to give up to be president?
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. A simple question. Who owns your kids? Who controls their daily activities? What are you allowed to do as a parent? Well, from the point of view of some governments, those children, I guess, are chattel property of the state. Kind of a communist idea, almost like what Cuba does with kids. The parents are allowed to be the parents of the children as long as their interests don't conflict with the state. At least that's what it reminds me of. Sarah Parshall Perry joins me now, who's a legal fellow at Heritage, vice president of the group Defending Education. Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Lars, thanks as always for having me.
This seems so simple that parents in this Maryland county, Montgomery County, say we want the ability when we see our kids are facing some indoctrinal kinds of activities at school, we want to be able to pull them out of school. And they're being told you're not allowed?
That's exactly right. In fact, this really is the quintessential parents' rights case that we've seen in a quarter century. The last time the Supreme Court ever weighed in on parental rights was back in the year 2000 in a case called Troxell versus Granville. But this goes to a very simple question. Do you burden the free exercise of religion rights of parents when you remove parental notice and opt-out rights when instructing kids on gender identity and sexuality? And the answer, I think, is a very clear yes. When you eliminate the opportunity for parents to direct their religious upbringing and inculcate the values of their faith in their minor child through mandatory curriculum that they cannot opt their children out of, I think the answer is that, yes, it is a pretty clear First Amendment violation.
I mean, maybe it'd be a lot easier, Sarah. I realize it may be wrong to wish for this, but if they were trying to serve, you know, the school breakfast that they sometimes serve, we're going to serve bacon and eggs to Muslim kids in a district. And I think they'd see such a hue and cry that they'd say, oh, no, no, that's not the direction we want to do. But this always seems, at least my impression is, it always seems to be aimed at Christians in this country, these kinds of things.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And I will tell you this, this case is an interesting procedural position because this is a multi-faith group of parents. In fact, the lead petitioner, Akmer Mahmoud, is obviously Muslim. There is also a group of Jews in this coalition and Orthodox Christians. Every one of them has asserted the same claim. We are all religious parents. We all believe men and women are created immutably by the creator that we believe in as male and female. And we want an opportunity to continue to teach our children just that way. But when you eliminate the opportunity to get our kids out of these classrooms, and Lars, these are 3, 4, and 5-year-olds who are being instructed in this, not only does it confuse them, but that eliminates the sanctity of the parent-child relationship in directing a child's religious upbringing. So this court is going to be faced with the first time they've considered parental rights in 25 years. But the question for me is a very simple one. Is it a violation not only of parental rights, but parental rights as concerns religious liberty? And once again, I don't see how the answer to that question is anything other than yes.
I'm talking to Sarah Parshall Perry. She's now vice president of the group Defending Education, as well as her position at Heritage. So would you mind sharing some of this with my audience? Because some of this sounds so bizarre that one book tells 3- and 4-year-olds to look for images from a word list that includes terms like intersex flag, drag queen, underwear, and leather. I mean, that sounds like
you've got that right.
An adult set of words.
You know, we have to laugh because the alternative, Lars, is that we have to cry. And as a parent of 3 myself, I have to tell you, if this had been my children's elementary, preschool, and grade school, I would have seen sky blue pink and would have been immediately on the phone with the principal of these schools. And yet, this is required reading material for inclusion in these story times in 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old classrooms. Not only is it age appropriate, we can take it strictly from the curricular standpoint of appropriateness or lack thereof for individuals that young, for children that minor. But it also goes to the question of whether or not human beings are sexed individuals with immutable biological characteristics, which is a fundamental belief for every major theology from time immemorial. They have very little in common, but they do share in common the notion of men and women as different and given men and women characteristics by their creator that are not changeable. But you manage, Montgomery County, to offend a whole host of these individuals, religious parents of all stripes in Montgomery County, by allowing and then removing curricular opt-out rights. And when under questioning, under trial, they were asked, why did you eliminate the parental opt-out rights? The answer was, because too many parents
everybody
were taking
opted
advantage
out
of it.
You end up with a classroom with three kids in it, and they all have, I guess, liberal left-wing parents of some kind. But what this is the reason they did it, because they found, because all the school district had to do to comply and avoid the trial and trip to the Supreme Court, if correct me if I'm wrong, would be to say, okay, we have four classrooms of this age kid. Three of them don't want this garbage. One classroom worth of kids does. We'll simply divide it out that way. They could have done that. Did they explain why they didn't?
Simply because they didn't want additional opt-out rights exercised, and they did not want, and this is a direct quote from the transcript, the other children who remained to feel stigmatized. So I have to tell you, this
but they
is a
are
calculus. They absolutely are. This is a calculus they could very well have gotten correct, but they decided to go to the mat. Now, let me tell you what a bad actor Montgomery County Public Schools are. This was the second of two cases that made it to the Supreme Court this term alone. The first was on a case specifically related to gender secrecy policies, social transitioning of minor children behind their parents' backs. Montgomery County Public Schools, one of the first school districts in the country to institute that kind of a program. Now, the Supreme Court did not take up that particular challenge, but they are 2-for-2 now, making two sets of challenges at the Supreme Court. And this was a case against Montgomery County that thankfully the Supreme Court decided to take. My hope is that they finally pin back the ears of the school administrators and the school leaders who are in Montgomery County putting sexual politics above instructional quality.
I totally agree, but one last quick question. When they saw this result, well, all the parents want to pull their kids out of this. A school board is chosen by the community to run the schools. Did they not take a message from that? The majority, a vast majority of our parents don't want this garbage?
You know, that's a great question, Lars, and one can only speculate as to why these individuals are still in the position in which they are. But even some of the principals of the schools, which of course are beholden to the school board and the school board's policies, said this is inappropriate material for minor children. So even the leaders of the schools within that school district, they beholden obviously to school district and school board leaders, didn't have a choice. They were told this is mandatory curricular inclusion. They themselves had a problem with it, as did the teachers themselves. Unfortunately, when you elect the wrong leaders, you always get the wrong outcomes.
Yeah, I would hope that that county would simply say, we're throwing the whole lot of you out. Kick the bums out and elect some sensible people who can actually make a decent decision. Sarah, thanks very much. That's Sarah Parshall Perry, who's a legal fellow at Heritage and vice president of the group Defending Education.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Donald Trump with a warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get you your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let me ask you a not-so-rhetorical question. If you had to take in your family or your business a 2% budget reduction, would you consider that catastrophic? Would you consider that making your financial future bleak if you had to take a 2% reduction? Now, what I'm talking about here is one of the many governments in the Pacific Northwest that's constantly pleading that they are short of cash. Multnomah County, for example, has a $4 billion overall budget. $4 billion a year. Now, of that, they have to spend most of it because only about $750 million of it is considered discretionary. But if you take that $750 million, the discretionary part, and then you say, well, how much of a cut are they taking? What is this thing that even the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, you know, Therese Bottomley's OregonLive.com, kind of a sad shadow of its former self as a real newspaper, they called it a bleak financial future. This is the way you get gaslighted by the mainstream media. A county government has to take a 2% cut in its general fund budget, which is an even smaller percent of its overall $4 billion budget. And they say, well, this our future is bleak. We're going to have to cut 2%. What in the world are we going to do? You know what they ended up doing? They did this. They have cut the district attorney's budget by $1 million. They have cut positions in domestic violence. Yeah, that's not all that important to address domestic violence. They have cut juvenile and treatment court units. So they're going to cut the DA's budget fairly substantially because they're in money trouble. Now, this is absolutely crazy. Jessica Vega Peterson, who is the chief executive of Multnomah County, is pushing for a 5% cut in the Department of Community Justice, totaling about $6 million. That's going to hit juvenile detention because apparently Portland isn't that very interested in dealing with juvenile crime, even though it seems like a problem to me, and cutting other kinds of programs, as I mentioned, domestic violence, sex crimes, and mental health treatment. So they're going to cut all of that because they're 2% short in their general fund budget and an even smaller percentage of their overall budget. That's absolutely crazy. But I'll tell you something that's even crazier. Multnomah County had, until the tail end of last year, a really terrible district attorney. His name was Mike Schmidt for Brains. And Schmidt for Brains had run that office into the ground. He had decided to drop his staffing levels. He didn't prosecute literally thousands of crimes that should have been prosecuted. And so today's new DA, the new DA is Nathan Vasquez. Now, I spent all of last year trying to get the new DA to come on because he was promising to do something different than Schmidt for Brains. And in fact, he appears to be in doing just that. You know what? Vasquez won't talk. And I got an email from his public information officer, who's a former reporter that I know, saying the DA is not pleased by the budget issued today for our office, and he has a lot to say about it. And as usual, I wrote a note to Pat Doris, and I said, hey, why don't you tell Nathan Vasquez to get on my program? My program goes out to the entire Pacific Northwest. And believe me, the folks in Seattle, the folks in Spokane, the folks in Eugene and Medford and all other places in the Northwest, they can appreciate what happens when you have a district attorney who doesn't do his job. And they can also appreciate when the new district attorney says he's actually going to go prosecute people. And what does the county do? They say they're going to cut his funding. I mean, on a conspiracy theory Thursday, I would suspect that maybe that's the agenda after all. Maybe the county, Multnomah County, does not want to see criminals prosecuted. And maybe that's what they think their constituents want. In any case, I thought I'd share that with you. Vasquez is invited here anytime he wants to come on. And by the way, he's one of those interviews I want to do with somebody who I largely agree with. So if he wants to say this is the wrong place to cut, I'd be glad to let him do it. But apparently he doesn't want to do that either. Let me welcome Ken Peterson. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Lars.
Ken's the writer and director of a new documentary called What Does It Cost About Energy Policies Here in the Pacific Northwest. Tell me what this documentary aims to tell people.
Well, it rises out of the 2019 in Washington and 2021 in Oregon laws that enshrine a net zero and actually an absolute zero requirement for reducing carbon dioxide from generating sources. And the question that I sought to answer was, okay, well, those are the laws. How much is it going to cost? And I tried diligently to get the people who supported the legislation and the departments and bureaucrats that, you know, are now overseeing it. And frankly, they didn't want to talk with me. And so in September, a paper analysis came out from the Discovery Institute in Seattle.
Yep.
That, in fact, from a couple of economists, and they tackled this issue. And so the documentary is about the answer to that question. What does it cost? And then what do you get for it?
Well, let me cut to the bottom line. Electricity rates are going to go up by what percentage as a result of this?
Well, the study shows that they'll go up from an average of 11 cents a kilowatt hour to about 26 cents a kilowatt hour.
And that's more than a doubling, and yet part of the report, yes. Doesn't part of the report say electric rates are going to go up by 450%?
They talk about the electric bill going up 450%, but some of that is because of the electrification that the states also, you know, are requiring with respect to house heating, building heating and cooling, as well as vehicles moving to electric. So the 450% relates to the entire bill, not the rate.
And how certain are they that this is going to be the result? Because I've not been a fan of the net zero nonsense. I think that if people want to become more efficient, most people do seek to use all forms of energy efficiently. I don't know of a lot of people who just waste it. So in this case, forcing this on the public at a cost of $500 billion to $1 trillion and a 450% increase in the cost of electricity seems outrageous for what it produces.
I think that you're right. and as you are alluding to there, when you get through with all of it, the question is, well, what do you get for that? Because the whole point of the legislation in the two states was to fight and defeat climate change. And I mean, that's stated very clearly in the law and in the people who supported it at the time. And what the study discovers when it puts in the relevant information into the EPA calculator of, you know, of climate change, even assuming that the EPA is correct, it turns out that if you eliminate the CO2 from electric generation by 2040, that by 2100, so letting it have a chance to do the good things it's supposed to do, by 2100, the temperature would decrease by less than 3,000 of 1%.
That is unbelievable. That's Ken Peterson, the writer and director of the new documentary called What Does It Cost? You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening.
This independent.
Some solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. First, I want to welcome Seton Motley from Less Government. Hey, Seton, welcome back.
Hey, man, how are you?
Not too bad, but one of your favorite hobby horses, and I would join you in it. I support what you say about the credit unions. I mean, I've always had a soft spot for credit unions, but they ought to be covered by the same rules as the banks and not get that advantage.
Exactly.
And you're saying that Doge is now showing just how rigged the game is.
Well, I just, what I'd like to see, and again, you know, I've been, it's hilarious. You know, you write these articles about these, you know, relatively, I don't want to say obscure, but, you know, these, I'm not writing about tariffs or something like that. And you're anti-credit union, you're pro-big bank. And I'm like, first of all, I've been anti-big bank for, you know, I was accused of being pro-big bank in the article, and I took two paragraphs out of the article and just posted it under their comment and said, what part of these two paragraphs is pro-big bank?
Yep.
And I'm not, and like you said, I'm not against credit unions. I would just like everybody to play by the same rules. Speaking of tariffs, that's the whole point of the tariffs, is we want everybody playing by the same rules internationally on trade. We'd like the credit unions to not have the advantages they have over other banks and or for-profit banks.
Yeah.
And again, this is my point is I want the small community banks to come back, and they're getting whipsawed between Dodd-Frank, which is the big banks law that they wrote to kill small banks, and then you have the credit unions who don't pay income tax and don't pay the NBIT tax, and then on top of that, because they're nonprofits, then on top of that, the NCUA, which oversees credit unions, has said, well, we're not going to require you to file your 990s, which, by the way, is what keeps them in good standing as a nonprofit. You get the advantage of being a nonprofit, but you have to prove you're living up to your obligations as a nonprofit. Not if you're credit unions, you don't have to file those anymore.
By the when you say they score $21 billion in tax savings by not having to pay all these taxes.
That's different than the income tax. Those are subsidies from the government.
Where does that turn?
They're nonprofits.
Where does that money go to if they're a nonprofit, so they can't make a profit, they don't have owners, then where does that extra cash go to? Does it all go back to benefit the customers of the credit unions, or does it end up in the pockets of the CEOs?
Well, that's up to each individual credit union. And, of course, as we learned, again, this is why I keep tying this to Doge, as we learned from Doge, the massive abuse of the nonprofit status of all these different nonprofits that Doge is uncovering, where they take private jets and the executives pay themselves high six figures, almost seven figure salaries.
Yep.
But hey, they're nonprofits. And so I'm concerned with all this cronyism. It has to be tempting. I don't care how saintly you are, if you're getting all of this government money and all these tax breaks and all these, you know, not paying taxes, at some point it's going to be tempting for the heads of credit unions to start pocketing more and more of the money that they're
And by the way, Seton, I'll tell you what, I'll be just as tough on conservatives, even people in Trump's administration, as I am on the liberals. Because, for example, right, you know, Pete Hegseth famously headed up a veterans nonprofit. And then he gave his brother a job there, and I think he was making six figures. So he was making a really good paycheck. And then when he goes to to work for Trump over at Defense, he gets his brother a job at the Homeland Security Department. I don't like those arrangements. I think they're flawed. A few years ago, a nonprofit hospital in my neck of the woods had a major controversy because they're paying their board of directors members like 50 grand a year. And you say, oh, so if you're a nonprofit, you can hand out these nice little sinecures to all these people. And you say, well, 50 grand, that's not much. Unless, of course, you're sitting on four or five boards of directors, in which case it's a really good chunk of change every year. And where's it coming from? A nonprofit. It's very profitable for some.
Or several nonprofits. And again, this gets us back to Doge again, which is how does Stacey Abrams go on continuous tour protesting her election loss? Well, it turns out she got $3 billion for her fake nonprofit from the federal government. And I don't, you know, I'm not saying the credit unions are doing what Stacey Abrams did, but this highlights the scam that is the nonprofit. And listen, Less Government is a 501c4 nonprofit, but I can assure you with moral fortitude, I'm not taking private jets to and from the U.S. from Belize. So, and I've gotten $0 total in my life from the federal government for my nonprofit, or from any other direction. All my transactions with the federal government have been one way in the other direction. like you said, whether it's Pete Hegseth or whoever, I want equal protection from before the law, because you lose respect for the law if you see, you know, something for thee but not for me. You just inherently lose respect for the entire system, no matter who the beneficiary is.
Absolutely right. That's Seton Motley from the organization, a nonprofit, less government. Seton, thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.